is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. The UW La Crosse Policy Research Network completed its first project this past spring. Its goal was to find whether hundreds of small businesses in western Wisconsin are entering the health care exchange that was established as part of the Affordable Care Act. La Crosse County UW Extension Director Mary Meehan Strube talked about the survey and its findings with Dr. Mary Hammond, an assistant professor of economics at UWL. Hammond first talks about the work of the Policy Research Network.
The Policy Research Network is a group at UWL where we are trying to involve undergraduates in real policy questions. And so we solicited topics from offices all around the state-level representatives. The topic we worked on was brought to us from Representative Kine's office, as well as local policy leaders. And really the goal here is to find out what sorts of information their offices need to drive policy and to allow our students to apply some of the things they're learning in the classroom to real-world projects. So, for example, when I teach statistics in my class, my students are much more interested if they actually get to produce results that will be used to drive real-world decision-making than just get them, you know, an A on my test. It's a real opportunity to take learning then beyond the classroom and produce results then that will go on beyond their one semester experience with me.
Why did you choose the Affordable Care Act as a topic?
Well, I'm a health economist, so for me, this is one of the most exciting things going at this point. But I also teach in the College of Business, and the class that I teach is to students who are beginning in our business program. It's one of our pre-business requirements. And so these students are going to go on into jobs in management and marketing and so on. And one of the biggest changes in the corporate world for them going forward is going to be the way in which we administer healthcare benefits, largely due to this policy. And so I thought that it was very important for students to understand some of this policy change at this time and to get a chance to hear from businesses in the Wisconsin area, small businesses, and hear how they're adapting to this law that they've heard so much about.
Who actually did this survey?
My students conducted this survey. So we took basically a one-line question that came from Representative Kine's office. He wanted to know whether or not small businesses are getting into the exchange. And I think he gave the example of, I think it was Papa's Donuts in Richland Center, just sort of a quintessential, here's a small business, have they gone out and shopped the exchange? So from there, my students went and did a lot of background research to determine what other things do we need to know to develop a good answer to that question. They wrote a survey, and we used a database here at UWL for contacting small businesses throughout the 3rd Congressional District. And what they've done here is actually a representative survey. They did it via email. We sent out surveys to roughly 970 small businesses in the area. We achieved about a 15% response rate, which is pretty standard for this sort of research.
I need to have you define what's a small business here when you've got almost 1,000 businesses there that you've surveyed. So is it 5 employees? Is it 50? Or is it less than 1,000?
Definitely. So this is something that we thought about in a lot of detail. And what we used were the breakpoints in the law really as our guide. So under the Affordable Care Act, businesses with 1 to 25 employees, they have the opportunity to receive tax credits towards the cost of their health insurance. And so that was one size group in survey parlance. That would be a strata within which we surveyed. And then we went with businesses from size 25 up to 50. We also surveyed within that group. They're not eligible for the tax credits, but they also will not become subject to the assessment. This is commonly known as the penalty for not providing health insurance as the law becomes fully implemented. And then finally, the last group we looked at were the smallest of the large, is the way we considered them. But really, they're still quite small. They are businesses of 50 to 100 employees. We consider those to be the smallest of the large because those are the smallest group that are required to provide health insurance or pay the assessment when the law is fully implemented. So in total, we covered the size range from 1 up through 100 employees, although we did omit self-employed persons.
Did all of these that you surveyed, did they currently provide insurance for their employees?
No, not all did. And actually, that was one thing that I wish we would have gotten a bit more detail on. We didn't ask any specific question about what they're currently providing. Okay. We did ask about whether or not they had currently browsed the shop. But in hindsight, that's something that we wish we would have asked. I think by and large for the 1 to 25, fairly few do, whereas mm-hmm. once you get up into that larger size class, as expected, the majority do.
So what was the response to the survey?
The headline question that mostly relates back to what Representative Kine's office started us out with, our business is browsing the shop. What our students found was really only around 20% of small businesses are. And just to be clear about what's behind that number, as of January 2014, businesses with 50 or fewer employees were eligible to go out and browse the shop. Now, they could do so, but to actually sign up for a plan, they would have to then go through a broker. They couldn't complete the entire transaction online. What we were asking about first was just, did they browse? And then we went on to, did they actually sign up for a plan? And that first question, we found only about 20% have been browsing the shop, and that's about the same in the 1 to 25 as it is in the 25 to 50 size class.
You asked if they browsed it, but then did they follow up and purchase a plan?
Very few did. And I think what's going on there is there's a lot of casual shopping at this point. There's really no impetus for them to do anything yet because some of the deadlines for the law have been rolled back. I think that there's sort of a wait-and-see approach right now, and there's a bit of confusion. There were several businesses, though, that did respond to our write-in questions that they didn't want to have to go out and complete the rest of the process with a broker. So I think perhaps as that process becomes more streamlined, some of the deadlines coming up begin to bind, we may see a change. But really the largest reason for the small percentage browsing at this point, based on our research, was they did not know what the shop was. So we asked a write-in question, why have you not browsed the shop? And the most common response was, what's the shop? And for those who don't know what that acronym stands for, it's the Small Business Health Options Program. And it has its own website separate from the individual exchange. I actually had my students go out and browse it themselves. I browsed it myself. In our opinion, it's actually fairly user-friendly. But there may have been some confusion among small business owners about whether or not there's even a separate website versus what's available on the individual exchange.
I liken it to the marketplace for individuals. The shop is what businesses use.
Yes.
In terms of being able to look at and purchase insurances for their employees, just like individuals can go on and purchase insurance through the marketplace for themselves.
That's exactly right. What's interesting as well is on that website, they do have some tools embedded to allow businesses to engage in some of this sort of casual shopping without even drilling down and looking at specific plans. There's a insurance premium calculator so that businesses can begin to see how much they might save if they were to find a shop plan. There's also a tax credit calculator. And my students researched use of those as well, and actually even fewer than 20% of businesses have used either of those two tools. For the calculator, actually among the 1 to 25 businesses, of those we surveyed, and we had about 68 businesses there in that group, we had zero who said they had used the tax
wow.
credit calculator, which was a bit alarming. We asked a separate question about whether or not businesses are currently using any tax credits that are available towards the provision of health insurance. And what was interesting there is we had many businesses respond that they were unsure. And understandably, I mean, small business owners are extremely strapped for mm-hmm. time. They outsource some of these duties and taxes. I don't know about you, but that's one of the things that my household definitely outsources. Mm-hmm. They're not exactly pleasant. But in that outsourcing, I think that some businesses then are not familiar with what credits they may be receiving at this point. And that's what seemed to be clear in our survey. When we asked, have you signed up for the tax credits that were already available to you in the last several tax years? We had a fairly high proportion of unsure for that question.
Many people who own businesses, because of the timing factor that you talked about, would look to their cadre of specialists that help them define what it is they need in business, they can't know it all. So they rely on an accountant or someone else to do that, tax prep and take advantage of tax credits.
I think what's unfortunate from a policy perspective then, though, is that we were hoping, certainly the intention of this policy is to make some of these changes more palatable to business owners by providing them with some savings to ease the burden of providing health insurance. But right now, the burden is very visible, and it's not clear that those tax credit opportunities are.
Well, and depending on your perspective, some people would say taking advantage of tax credits is great, and others are going to say, oh, we shouldn't be offering those. Mm-hmm. However, within the Affordable Care Act, they are available, and so it could be a savings for people who operate or own and or operate businesses.
Absolutely. I mean, I think some of the original design behind the policy there is to correct a problem in the health insurance market in this country that's existed for a long time. And it's that small businesses are severely disadvantaged when it comes to providing affordable health care for their employees. You know, many of our largest employers self-insure. So they don't contract out with someone like Blue Cross Blue Shield. They have a large enough risk pool, and they're able to negotiate very affordable health care for their employees. If you only employ 10 people, you can't spread that risk out as efficiently, and therefore you, by definition, will pay more for health insurance unless you can participate in a larger marketplace. So I think that was the original intent behind the law, was to open up some of these more affordable opportunities to the smaller employers to help them comply with providing full insurance. However, I'm not sure that many of these business owners are satisfied with the execution, or many individuals are satisfied mm-hmm. with the execution. And I think that came across in our research as well. My students did ask a couple of questions at the very end of the survey to try and take a political temperature. You know, obviously, we've done a lot of polling. We have a good feel for how the average American feels about healthcare reform, but a lot of what they're responding to there is on the individual side. So we asked at the end of our survey, after all of these questions about the small business side, do you think that the Affordable Care Act should be repealed? And at that point, we had about a 50-50 response in terms of thinking that it should be repealed. But then we asked when the assessment becomes binding of those employers with 50 or more employees, how many of them would choose to pay the assessment rather than provide health insurance? The majority said that they would provide the health insurance.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm Mary Mian Strube, and my guest today is Dr. Mary Hammond, an assistant economics professor here at UW La Crosse. We're talking about a survey done by the UW La Crosse Policy Research Network that asked small businesses in western Wisconsin what involvement they've had with the Affordable Care Act so far. Now, Mary, you've talked about the question of taking a look at the shop and then having people and businesses identify what they've done with premium calculators and if they've utilized or are aware of the tax credits. But I think you also asked businesses about, has it affected their employees? Have they had any turnover, or have they had to adjust and downsize at all? And what did you find with that?
Right. So this was particularly interesting because it was while I was teaching this class and working with these students on this project that the Congressional Budget Office report came out that made a lot of waves predicting some fairly sizable changes in employment in response to this law. And there are some interesting cut points. So, for example, if you have 51 full-time employees, you would then be subject to the assessment down the line if you do not provide health insurance, whereas if you have fewer than 50, you do not have to pay the assessment. You do not then face any penalty for not providing health insurance. Similarly, on the smaller side, if you have more than 25 employees, you don't qualify for the tax credits. If you have fewer, you do. And so there was this expectation that perhaps employers may be changing the number of employees to take advantage of some of the benefits and avoid some of the costs inherent in the law. And interestingly, what my students found is that very few changes have already been made in terms of turnover or changing employees from full-time to part-time, and few employers are predicting that they will make changes in the future. For us, that was quite an interesting finding among small businesses, because it kind of contradicts what we saw nationally, at least predicted by that CBO report.
And that was that we thought for sure that there was going to be downsizing.
That's right. Obviously, what we're doing right now is prospective. We don't have any actual data on the decisions that they've made once the law is implemented, because clearly the law isn't fully implemented yet. But when we ask them what they intend to do going forward, we're really not seeing any signs that there'll be a striking change in employment.
As you and your students worked with the shop, did you find that there are a lot of plans available for small businesses to choose from in this area?
I would say yes. When we browsed ourselves, that's kind of a difficult question, right? Because it depends a lot on who the small business is, how many employees they have. And while we can look and say, yes, there's a large listing of plans here, whether or not an individual business owner would find those to be attractive or affordable or meet the needs of their employees is very tough for us to know. But what I can say is when we went through and browsed, it did seem to be fairly user-friendly. It did seem to be fairly quick to get a good listing and begin to compare across. We did have a few businesses who had browsed complain about the metal system, the gold, silver, bronze, and so on, saying that that actually was more hindrance than helpful. But I think at the end of the day, it's difficult to compare across plans. And that was the case before the Affordable Care Act. It will remain the case going forward. It's a very complex contract that you're entering into on behalf of your employees and a complex benefit to offer. And so it will take some research for organizations to figure out what they wish to offer.
Now, since the rollout of the Affordable Care Act didn't go off as originally was planned, and it was delayed a couple of years. In terms of business in particular, it was delayed for the small businesses. Are the results of what you and your students found here surprising?
I would say in some ways they're surprising that we found so many businesses that actually have browsed at this point, because really there's not a lot of incentive for them to go out and be looking at the shop yet. There's a lot of frustration currently around healthcare reform in general and a feeling that this is very complex and not so user-friendly. We heard about a lot of complaints about the individual side of the exchange and the website for that marketplace. And I'm wondering if there was some spillover then into the small business side. And frankly, seeing about 20% have actually browsed the shop thus far was a bit higher than what I would have expected.
They've browsed it, but not used it.
That's right. That's right. Okay. And so I think a lot of this, again, is sort of curious shopping, or they may have done so when they thought that they would need to have a plan in place by 2014. And then decided to back off and wait for their next plan year, wait to begin browsing until 2015. I think the other issue also is that currently they can't go through and complete the entire transaction online. So they can go, look, find a plan that they like, but then they still need to get on the phone and speak with a broker. So especially for business owners that are used to taking care of a lot of their transactions seamlessly online, we're a bit spoiled. I mean, Amazon.com has spoiled a lot of us in terms of expecting that whole transaction to take place rather seamlessly. And I think until the website really gets up to speed there, it's asking a lot of business owners to go through and complete the full transaction. And so I think it's interesting that they're looking now. I'm not terribly surprised that very few have completed the transaction.
As you look back on the study from this past year, were there any limitations that were a part of it? As with all kinds of research, there's always somebody that can find one, and I'm expecting that your students probably looked at that right up front.
Certainly, certainly. So part of my job is to teach them a bit about study design. So when we first started talking about who we were going to survey, we didn't have a budget to send out mail surveys. We didn't have the ability to go and do in-person interviews in such a short time span. This was a one-semester-long project from research question through survey design through data collection and analysis. And that's a lot to accomplish, in the space of about 14 weeks. So we decided to go with an email survey. And there's definitely some bias inherent in doing an email survey, especially when you're wanting to learn about use of a web-based service. So we had a listing of businesses, and it included all businesses in the 3rd Congressional District in these size classes. It's a fairly comprehensive database. But then we went out and we looked up email addresses for these businesses. And students actually did this by hand. I've since found there are a few resources that we could use, although I'm not convinced they would be quite as thorough as what my students actually were able to accomplish with their work. But those businesses that do not have a website and do not have an email address listed are probably least likely to go and use a web-based service to shop for health insurance. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if anything, I think our numbers would be a bit of an overestimate of the proportion of businesses that are actually using the shop. And so it may be less than 20% that are using it at this point.
Looking at limitations is one part, but then let's take a look at recommendations based on what you found and the students as they analyzed it. What are the recommendations that they prepared as a result of their study?
Sure. I think one of the key recommendations is that there needs to be more information provided to businesses, and particularly with respect to some of the tools available to them, like the tax credit calculator or the premium calculator, that are even simpler than going out and browsing specific plans. It allows them to sort of get their feet wet, see what savings may be available, and then start to drill down and look at specific plans. And right now, at least in our opinion, we thought that some of the links to those resources were a bit buried on the shop website. They weren't featured quite as prominently as what they could be. Mm-hmm. So we thought that that would be a good opportunity for businesses to begin learning a bit more. The other thing, though, was to try and divorce some of the business side of the exchange from the individual marketplace. Because right now, I think for many business owners, there's a bit of a confusion. We had a few write-in responses where clearly the business owner was thinking about health insurance that he as an individual or she as an individual had purchased for their own family. Just getting across the difference between the two marketplaces is a key point so that we don't have quite so many businesses just saying, what is the shop? My students did specifically look at whether or not the chambers of commerce in the area might be a good vehicle for providing resources to local businesses, providing some education. And in fact, we did survey among all chambers of commerce in the 3rd District for which we could obtain contact information and asked what they'd been doing thus far. And we had two or three chambers that are quite active that have provided a lot of information, hosted speakers, and they actually post links on their website to assist their members with complying with the ACA. Others did not do so. At this point, there are a few, I think, that were concerned about the politically charged nature of healthcare reform. But I think more often than not, what we were hearing is the chambers are as overwhelmed as their members are. For example, in my local chamber, I've worked with him. I've worked with their president on a few projects. And I know that he is a business owner himself. Uh-huh. And so there's no full-time position for many of these chambers in these smaller communities. And therefore, just put one more thing on their plates, I think, may be a bit much. But I do know that that particular avenue actually is one that Representative Kind had been sort of independently investigating, which was kind of a happy coincidence because then we were able to provide some information for him in his office about how receptive chambers may be. And I think that if perhaps there are some prepackaged materials, good links to the premium calculator and the tax credit calculator made available to the chambers, perhaps there's an opportunity for some partnership.
Mary, as you reflect on the results of the survey and what the students have prepared, were there any surprises to you?
I guess I was a bit surprised to hear many businesses, first of all, say, what is the shop? I wasn't surprised that so few had browsed, but I guess it was a little bit surprising to me to know that they weren't even familiar with the business side of the healthcare exchange. I think as well, it was a bit eye-opening, although understandable, to hear many businesses say, we have an accountant who takes care of this when asked about tax credits. Well, of course they do. They're very, very busy folks. But I think it's a little bit then surprising to me that that translates into a lack of awareness about some of the benefits available to them under the law. And I think for me personally helps to explain why some pieces of the law are perhaps viewed so negatively. Because, of course, if you don't know the dollars and cents that you may be saving due to a particular policy, but you do know all the hurdles you need to jump, you're not going to favor that policy. And so I think some of this is impression management. And of course, there may be things about the law that still folks who are fully informed don't agree with. You know, there are things that had I been in the driver's seat, perhaps I would have done differently. Mm-hmm. But I think that the lack of information about what is currently in the law is definitely problematic and came through quite clearly in the survey.
Implications for the future.
I think providing more information is extremely important. I think we've given policymakers some good guidance for moving forward. I think for UWL and for our students here, this was an incredible experience, an opportunity to provide real-world analysis that actually will move beyond the classroom and beyond their semester with me. So late in the semester, we actually found out Representative Kine was going to be making a visit to campus, and this was about 10 days after we had closed our data collection. And I said to my students, we have a shot to present preliminary results for him in person. Do you want to take this shot? And I really run my classroom a lot like a business, and so this was kind of decided as a group, as an entity, do we want to go for this? And they said overwhelmingly yes. I'm still so impressed by the tight turnaround they went through to provide some of these preliminary results. They presented and had a great dialogue with Representative Kind, had the opportunity then to revise some of their analysis, think about it in different ways, and that engagement with a public policy leader was truly a great experience for my students and a great teaching opportunity for me as well. So I think going forward, we really are seeking more of this community engagement at UWL. The Undergraduate Policy Research Network is a good tool to facilitate it. We're looking for questions that policymakers want answers to. And to the extent that we can address them by involving these young people in their communities, I think we're creating people that will continue to be involved in civic engagement going forward. They'll be more educated voters, hopefully be more educated business owners and entrepreneurs someday as well.
What are your intentions in terms of the results of the survey and how it can be used?
At this point, we will be releasing the report for public use. We went through all of our human subjects approvals, and that information will be available. The data, however, are not available for use beyond our students. That was not part of our release process with our survey participants, and we have to be very careful about our human subjects research approvals there. But we do hope that some of this will make it into the dialogue, that some of this will help to inform how we implement the law going forward, and perhaps help to make Wisconsin business owners a bit more aware that there's information out there they don't currently possess. And as a group, perhaps they stand to benefit by gaining some more information.
Do you have plans for other surveys involving the Affordable Care Act?
Certainly. I think going forward, Representative Kine's office had a few follow-up questions for us. We also have some questions on the individual side. So I believe it was Governor Walker's office actually wanted to know about the transition from Badger Care as the Affordable Care Act is fully implemented and having those folks go out onto the individual side of the exchange. That was one that I actually had considered looking at within the past year, but then that deadline was pushed back as well. And so we're going to wait on that a bit longer. But it's not just me going out after these topics either. There are several faculty outside of the College of Business as well in the Department of Political Science. Several of us are working on these topics. And I think there's so many interesting questions for our students to push for.
Anything more that you've not been asked that you would like to share?
I just want to emphasize that none of this work is my own. This was work undertaken by 22 very bright and talented individuals, mostly sophomores and juniors for us at UWL. For most of them, this is their first experience with research. And watching the extent to which they got engaged and got involved in this topic was just really exciting. There's some bright young people at UWL. This was actually my first year as a faculty member here. And I have to say, I was just extremely impressed by the talent and the work ethic, because this was a huge undertaking for them. They were very overwhelmed at the beginning of the semester, and just to look back on everything they accomplished was really exciting.
Dr. Mary Hammond is an assistant professor of economics at UW-La Crosse. She spoke with La Crosse County UW Extension Director Mary Meehan Strube about a survey of hundreds of small businesses in Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District. Students in Hammond's economics class worked on the project and helped conduct the first survey by the UW-La Crosse Policy Research Network. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Coming up next, a new series of islands on the Mississippi River near Ferryville are designed to improve the habitat for fish and wildlife. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. There, you'll also find a link to UW-La Crosse's Policy Research Network. For updates on future shows, links to our archives and more, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. The islands of the Mississippi River have been disappearing for decades. Although nature plays a bit of a role in the erosion, it's mostly caused by the lock and dam system's river engineering. Recognizing the loss of habitat, state and federal agencies have been working together to build new islands, an effort that has been underway since the 90s. The Kapolei Slough Habitat Rehabilitation Project, midway between La Crosse and Prairie du Chien, is just one example. Its goal is to enhance the river's ecosystem for fish, birds, turtles, and even people. I toured the Kapolei Slough Islands near Ferryville, Wisconsin this past week with Jeff Jandrin. He's a Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Mississippi River Habitat Specialist. Also, Wendy Wycheck, a wildlife biologist with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife and Fish Refuge in La Crosse. While Jandrin drives the boat, he talks about the history of the project.
The Kapolei Slough Project is located on the Upper Mississippi River Wildlife and Fish Refuge on the Mississippi River. And it's designed by a team of biologists and engineers from the Corps of Engineers, Iowa, Wisconsin DNR, and the Fish and Wildlife Service. We've been working on this project about since 1999. Due to funding, we kind of took a break from the planning and then started up in earnest again in the late 2009 period or so. And just kind of went forward and got to construction. So this is actually the third year of construction on this project.
And can you talk about Fish and Wildlife Service's participation in the project, Wendy?
It's a partnership, just like Jeff said, with all the agencies. We all have biologists and managers that work on the projects and engineering people that help out with the design and everything. So it's a great partnership that we have with everybody.
If I'm understanding it correctly, one of the reasons that projects like this have to take place is because the way that the river has been engineered over time, some of the original islands, or islands that were there 100 years ago, have eroded away.
In the 1930, Congress authorized the Corps of Engineers to put in locks and dams on the Mississippi River. And actually, the refuge was here already. They started in 1924 on the river. When the locks and dams went in, it permanently raised the water elevation to create a stair step of water from Minneapolis-St. Paul to St. Louis, Missouri. And when that stair step went in, we flooded out roughly a third of the floodplain of the Mississippi River. And that covered up the islands, or what islands that didn't totally submerge, wind action, waves, ice started eroding them away. And those islands that were there after locks and dams were still holding on some of the habitat that was out there for fish and wildlife. We've lost in Pool 9, for example, almost 60% of our floodplain forest that was here before the locks and dams were built. Most of that is now water, and so these islands also help restore a little bit of that forestry out there.
Can you talk about the makeup of the islands that work is underway on? What do they look like? What is the size?
I think we got a 22 acres of islands that we reconstructed down here in the Kapolei Slough Project. All of the islands start out with a sand base, and then we put topsoil that's dredged then from the backwaters, and that dredging from the backwaters creates deep water habitat then for fisheries, in particular for overwintering fish like bluegill and largemouth bass that need these quiet areas free from current to spend the winter. And it's a natural thing. Most folks don't think about bluegills and largemouth bass as a fish of a river, but for the Mississippi River floodplain, they were pre-lock and dam a major part of it, and even today they're still a very major component of the fishery for this river system.
And one of the thought processes behind this is it helps create winter habitat for the fish. Can you talk about that?
A lot of the fish on the Mississippi River are migratory. Some will migrate literally hundreds of miles, like the paddlefish, the sturgeon, even some of the catfish. But the bluegills, largemouth bass, they'll migrate from where they spend the summer to where they spend the winter. And that's what we call overwintering habitat when we're reconstructing these islands. Up in this portion of the Mississippi River, summer habitat really isn't limiting. It's that overwintering habitat that's free from current, a little bit warmer than the main channel, because the main channel runs at 0 degrees centigrade or 32 degrees Fahrenheit during the winter under the ice. And the fish will avoid that. Matter of fact, there's some studies that show that if they spend too much time in that kind of water, they die. So we have to create these overwintering sites then that have good oxygen, a little bit warmer temperatures, even 1 degree C, that they want to then spend the winter in. And we also have done telemetry studies, the Iowa DNR has, that shows these fish will home back to wintering sites. That's how important they are, is that they've evolved to home back to probably what is the most critical habitat for their survival.
Wendy, can you talk about some of the benefits to migratory birds?
Sure. The design of the islands helps decrease wind and wave action that occurs, and so that has a couple benefits for waterfowl. It helps reduce the suspended sediments that are in the water, which then helps the vegetation grow, and then which provides food for the waterfowl. Another, it provides protection for them so that they can get out of the wind and the waves, and so a place for food and a place for protection.
What sort of birds do you generally see out on these islands?
We get a mix of waterfowl that's out there. One of the biggest ones that we have in these lower pools where you have a lot of the open water is the canvasback. But we do have where the vegetation comes in, mallards and wood ducks will feed in there, and just a good mix of waterfowl that use the area.
This is Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. We're visiting the Capitalized Slough Habitat Restoration Project, a state and federal effort to restore islands of the Mississippi River south of La Crosse. My guests are Jeff Janvrin, he's a Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Mississippi River Habitat Specialist, and Wendy Wycheck, a wildlife biologist with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife and Fish Refuge in La Crosse.
The Capitalized Slough Islands are in an area that's open to hunting and fishing year-round. Further south is a project that's going to start next summer of 2015.
And what's the name of that project?
That one's called Harper Slough, Pool 9. And that area is pretty much all in a closed area. So it's a waterfowl closed area, and that is someplace that it's closed to hunting. So that's an area for the waterfowl then to rest. By putting in the islands that we're putting in, not only at Capitalized but also down at Harper's, that's actually going to increase diversity of habitat. So the divers will still be in the area, but you'll see an increase likely in swans and puddle ducks like mallards and teal, because now they're going to utilize that quiet water area. Because by slowing down the current, breaking up the wind fetch, we change the vegetation community as well back there for the food resources, so that the food isn't all just wild celery, but rather it could be, you know, the arrowheads out there and a whole variety of other aquatic vegetation and invertebrates that the waterfowl feed on.
Does it help with erosion too?
Well, the plants that we put out for erosion, we use a lot of bioengineering on the islands. If it's a shoreline, that'll allow it. And so we'll plant willows along the shoreline. And we actually went out, surveyed, looked where willows were growing naturally on islands. And that's where we plant them along the islands to give the island a head start to be stable. Our primary goal is to use no rock if we can, but we designed these islands to last for 50 years, and so we do have to use riprap and rock on these islands. We plant the top of the islands with a mixture of prairie grasses also, so that it helps lock up the soil, helps reduce erosion as it's overtopped. As far as during the summer, if you get the vegetation beds established behind the islands, they will break up that wind as it's coming in. It's a lot calmer, it helps reduce the resuspension of the sediment in the water column. The catch-22 on that, though, is the vegetation really is only doing that in late June through mid to late September. So you still have another 8-9 months out of the year where the aquatic vegetation really doesn't offer a lot of protection to the islands. And that's then where our design of the island itself is what's helping keep it stable.
But at this point, I know you're putting the final touches on the islands, but, you know, 10 years down the line, would you go out there and plant new vegetation, or once it's finished, do you just sort of let nature take its course?
I think, at least from our standpoint, we like to just see natural succession occur. But if there are areas where we could see some significant improvement, say putting in wild rice, you know, we wouldn't be opposed to going in and looking at that and evaluating that and actually seeding some wild rice in an area. So there's always that possibility, but nature does really well when we let it go that direction. So
you mentioned that you try not to use rocks in these projects. Why is that?
Well, one, we don't like using rock unless absolutely necessary on the islands, because there is a point where it increases the cost of the island. And everything that we need to build these islands has to be brought out here on a boat. If you need a roll of toilet paper, it comes out on a boat. The outhouses come out on a boat. So it gets expensive, and the sand and the mud, that's all right around here. And if we can use it, that's the cheap way to go. But you're making an investment, in this case, of over $4 million. I think it's almost $6 million for this overall project. You want to make sure that it's going to stay here. The refuge, they have to maintain this. They have to sign a cooperator's agreement that they will maintain these islands for 50 years. And one of the things that we as a partnership really try to do is design these islands so that there is no maintenance, so that they literally are maintenance-free. Matter of fact, most of the maintenance we've had to do on these is folks coming out to inspect it to say, yep, everything's doing fine. And that's the kind of maintenance you want to do on something that you build. So there is a lot of advantage. Folks may say some of this is over-designed, but at the same time, the money spent, it's here. It's causing the benefits to the public from bird watching, from hunting, from fishing, and just the general ecosystem of the Mississippi River.
What difference does it make for fishers who... There's a fisherman right behind us.
Well, for the angling population, these overwintering sites, all the monitoring we've done to date shows that they are brand new populations, particularly in an area like Kapolei, where we're going and doing something in an area where there wasn't an overwintering site before. So these actually are a brand new population of fish. We are actually increasing the overall population within a pool. Cumulatively over time, with a lot of these projects, we will definitely restore a much healthier, much more diverse fisheries within the pools. And one thing that kind of is a theory is that a more diverse system is more resilient to stressors, whether that be invasion of exotic species, climate change, etc. If you have a very simple system, very monotypic system, it's more susceptible to any type of a change that then sets back or could destroy the ecosystem that's there. I'm going to pop up on plane here because we still got like 2 miles to go.
This is Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. We're visiting the Kapolei Slough Habitat Restoration Project, a state and federal effort to restore islands of the Mississippi River south of La Crosse. My guests are Jeff Janvrin, he's a Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Mississippi River Habitat Specialist, and Wendy Wycheck, a wildlife biologist with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife and Fish Refuge in La Crosse.
So today as we're out here, the water's still high. I mean, we're still in flood on the river here. So a lot of our islands are actually, or portions of the lower sections of the islands are actually underwater. And they're designed to do that. We design these islands to be flooded. We have, if you want to think about it, pressure relief areas where we want the water to get into the backwater to equalize the pressure or the water surface elevation. When we get a flood, if we don't allow water to come in and kind of fill up the cup, we basically can get erosion of the constructed islands because of what we call hydraulic jump. It's lower in the backwater, it's higher in the main channel, and we want to equalize that water level. And one way to think about it is if you take a garden hose, you lay it out on the ground, that water will just spread out. But if you take that same garden hose and with the trickle of water going on and hold it above your head, it's going to eat a hole in the ground. That's the energy water's getting from gravity, and we try to take that away from the river as it's going in these backwaters so we don't erode the islands that we built.
The project's been underway for a handful of years now. What's some of the work that needs to be completed this year?
Over the last 2 years, two different contractors have been working on this project, so everything's put out for competitive bid. And in the case of Kapolei, each one was awarded to a different contractor. McHugh Excavation last fall, late September, early or mid-October, finished putting in the last of the islands. So for all practical purposes to the aquatic creatures, this project's been functioning since, let's say, late October of last year. The erosion control for all the islands is in already. They've got the rock work in. Some of it right now actually is underwater, and that's by design as far as that you can't see it. But what they're going to do is they're going to shape it now. They're going to take the roughness out of it, get the elevations a little bit more smooth, because wherever you have a little depression, that's where you can get some erosion on the islands. Then they'll come back and they'll plant it to kind of a prairie mix, and they also plant the willows along the toe of the island. And then depending on what is agreed to, actually what it usually comes down to is what the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Corps decide they'd like to do, along with input from the partners, is which islands then are we going to plant trees on? Because we will plant trees to diversify the forest community that's coming up. So some of the higher portion of this island, I'm confident we'll be getting things like, they'll be getting some oak trees will be planted onto that section of the island, as well as some other trees that are a little less tolerant of having their feet wet. Whereas then we'll get in some of these lower sections of the islands, and they might actually plant in some different kinds of maples or willows just to give them kind of a head start on the islands here.
So this looks like an island that's been established for quite a while, hence the trees.
Yep. So one big part of the Capilli project was protecting the existing islands that were still here, and then kind of using them as a template to basically, if you want to think about it, connect up the dots.
So is this part right in front of us, is this a new portion of the project, and then that's older
vegetation? Part of the older island that was okay. There, where all the bigger trees had fallen down, so just the little willows were mm-hmm. growing. And this island here was finished up by the fall of 2012. And what I can see just by looking at it is it's functioning the way it should. It's a channel, or it's an island right next to the main channel. And done right, what we should see every time it gets flooded is a fresh deposit of sand on top of the island. That's what makes up the natural river levees that you see on a lot of different rivers that you go on. But on the Mississippi River, that's kind of what over 10,000 plus years created the islands was, as it was leaving the main channel, it would pile up sand because it lost its energy as it went over the top of islands. And that's what's happening here. So this is actually what we're looking at is some fresh sand that's deposited on top of this island by the river, which means it's actually functioning as part of the river's landforms. So, and this is one we'll get out on this one because then you can see the difference between that rough area that we were versus one that's shaped.
If these weren't here, how different would the river system be, or at least the ecosystem?
These projects are really helping restore a bunch of habitat. We did some looking at historic data and looked at what the distribution of overwintering habitat was for bluegills and largemouth bass, or I should say the potential, back before locks and dams were built. And it came out that in this area, there was probably about 1.5 overwintering sites per river mile. Well, let's put that in context. Today, with the locks and dams, from Lansing, Iowa, down south of Linksville, Wisconsin, at Lock and Dam 9, we had one overwintering site, and that was at Cold Springs. And that's a stretch of about 12, 13 miles, and Cold Springs is one of our habitat projects. So before even EMP, we were down to the point where, for in an area that probably had at least 10, if not more, overwintering sites per in a 12, 13-mile stretch, we had zero before the environmental management program. This represents the second overwintering site now that we are creating as part of it to fill in this gap. And then there are features in the Harper's project that will also provide some overwintering habitat as well. So slowly but surely, putting the pieces back of this real, you know, national treasure puzzle that's out here on our river.
And like Jeff said, the erosion process is just continuing, and so if we don't do something now, we'll lose all these islands completely. And some people are like, well, what does that mean? Well, you're going to have a flat bottom, and you're going to have that monotypic vegetation type again. And the wave and wind action, when it gets into these big open waters, the wind creates large waves, which again just makes the sediment come up. It can even rip up the vegetation. So we're losing habitat. So by putting these islands back in place, we're really creating a diverse habitat that will help a lot of different species.
Wendy Wycheck is a wildlife biologist with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife and Fish Refuge in La Crosse. Jeff Jandrin is a Wisconsin DNR Mississippi River Habitat Specialist. We were touring the Capilli Slough Habitat Restoration Project, a state and federal effort to restore islands on the river near Ferryville, Wisconsin, between La Crosse and Prairie du Chien. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Stroob, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make a suggestion for a future show, you'll find links to our producers and staff, that and more, at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, photos, and links to our archives, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.